Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Meet Natural Cycles, the only FDA-cleared and CE-marked birth control app that's 100% natural, hormone-free, and side-effect-free. Here's how it works. The app analyzes daily changes in your body temperature to find your fertile window so you can plan or prevent pregnancy naturally. Natural Cycles is a clinically proven, non-hormonal birth control option that's 93% effective with typical use and 98% effective with perfect use. No synthetic hormones, just science. And if you're ready to start family planning, switching from preventing to planning a pregnancy is as easy as tapping a button. Plus, the Natural Cycles app makes tracking fertility easy. You can measure your temperature trends using an Oura Ring, Apple Watch, or our Bluetooth thermometer, which is free when you sign up for an annual subscription. Join over 4 million registered users who are taking control of their fertility naturally. Save 15% when you sign up with code RADIO15 at naturalcycles.com. That's RADIO15 for 15% off today.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
There's an old saying about hating to write but loving to have written. A lot of times I think I feel like that, like the sense of accomplishment, the challenge. I think that's motivating in itself. And I suppose if I didn't feel daunted each time, then it'd be a little bit like one of those notions of why keep doing it if you don't feel like that.
And our guest this week is Vahe Gregorian. He is one of the country's top sports columnists. He writes for the Kansas City Star. He graduated from Swarthmore High School, went to the University of Pennsylvania, played a little football for the Quakers. And Vahe, thanks so much for taking the time.
Matt, it's great to be with you, and thanks a lot for having me.
So as we are recording this, late June, starting to roll into the summer, what is the day-to-day for you? What's the focus? I guess a lot of Royals and gearing up for the Chiefs?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. We just had our last day of the off-season program with the Chiefs yesterday and spent some time with Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce, who, you know, Travis kind of rarely talks to the media these days, so that's always stop the presses. I'm being facetious a little bit, but it is of interest. And so that's it. And now, yeah, mostly Royals, get ready for the college football season, and of course, figure out when I'm going to get my Jersey Shore time in the upcoming weeks. Got to slide in between the Chiefs' last preseason game and their opener in Brazil this year.
What's the Shore town? Where is your stop at the Jersey Shore?
Typically Ocean City. We've got a lifelong friend, basically, my Penn Quaker friends, John and Susan Shirk, who make their home there year-round. So John and I played football together at Penn, and we've been close ever since. So it's pretty cool to stay connected there, and always go back through Swarthmore too. I haven't lived there in more than 40 years, but I still feel like it's my hometown.
So, from a columnist standpoint, how often are you writing?
Typically, it really depends on the time of year. About a week ago, I realized I'd written 9 days in a row, and I bring that up because there's a lot more slow times, so it feels like in June and July, it's often difficult to have more of the daily stuff. So you're often it's two or three times a week this time of year, four and five during the busier times. The upside of that is that this time of year, we're typically trying to think in terms of sort of project-like things that maybe we don't normally get to do. And so I've got some, you know, lines in the water for a few longer type of more substantial pieces, but that's kind of the rhythm of it. More or less from August through the end of football, which has been going pretty late here in Kansas City lately, it's a lot of 6 and 7 day weeks and 4 and 5 days of columns.
I want to pull the curtain back for the listeners. Kind of, how does it work as a columnist? Is it something that you come up with all the ideas and you're kind of given kind of carte blanche to pursue? Do editors come to you and say, hey, can you get something like this or focus on this at some point in the next couple of weeks? Kind of let us know how it works.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it really is a mix of that. And I think it's different every place. Like, for instance, there are some papers or news outlets, whatever we call ourselves these days, that sort of have specific writing days where the couple columnists are writing X day each week. We don't do it that way. It's a little more organic. We're just basically always desperate for ideas, trying to find what we can. The way it typically works for us is I sure better be generating my own ideas. Naturally, the boss has ideas from time to time and we'll kick them around, but seldom is there anything resembling a mandate like you got to write this about that. There are certain topics that if something happens that we know is very significant news, nobody really needs to tell us, we need to get on it. I mean, that's sort of the nature of the beast, a lot of nights and weekends and sudden work. But the flip side of this too, and this is very energizing, the best example I can give you is we typically have 4 people covering the Chiefs. So we all have our own ideas, but we all also want everybody to prosper. So a lot of times we're kind of moving the ball around, trying to figure out who's going to do what and how that's going to best suit what they're saying. 2 of us are columnists, so we have more voice and latitude in what we write. So that often affects how that works. So pretty much, though, the essence of your question can be answered this way. I mean, I have a list here at all times of 20 to 25 things. I know a number of them won't work out. I hope most of them do. And then you wake up to the reality of going on to the next. So it's ideas are the, I mean, the writing is its own separate challenge. I still, you know, get both exhilarated and panicked at the blank screen you start with. But everything, the idea is everything.
How often, if at all, do you struggle to come up with something? And I don't mean the general idea, but to find your voice isn't the right quote, but to find the focus and to tell the story the way that you wanted to tell it in your head. Is that something you ever have problems with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, it's at the crux of everything. And look, I don't think it's too far flung to say your voice or your focus. Both of those things, I think, are really it. I always liken it to a jigsaw puzzle a little bit. And I just feel like I got to get all my pieces, try to understand what's there, and then really try to think what is the best way to synthesize what I'm saying. And it's rare that I start anywhere in the body of the story other than the lead, because you usually think of the lead as the way you can have an umbrella over everything. So sometimes it's anecdotal, sometimes it's something just factual, sometimes it's a point of color. I'm glad you asked me that question, because I don't think I ever say it out loud or really think about it that way, but it is all that. It's just kind of constantly turning the Rubik's Cube to get it to where you hope it adds up.
I'm curious because you're one of the folks who, when you read your stuff, you make it seem so easy and it makes such sense. How often, if at all, do you write something and then you reread it and you're like, nah, this isn't it. I didn't hit it. I got to start again. Or is it such a crafting process that you maybe realize you don't like what you put together much, much earlier?
Yeah, hopefully you recognize it much earlier, but I'll tell you, there's almost never a time I close the laptop. In fact, I can think of maybe 2 or 3 times in thousands of stories where I close the laptop and said, you know, boy, I had that exactly right. I nailed it. It's just, I don't know if it's something neurotic or if it's just human nature to keep thinking about what you could do better. I wish I could relax about it a little bit more than I do, because it you know, sometimes you add unnecessary stress. A lot of times I'm upset with myself when I'm done and then feel a little more relieved when I look at it the next day. That's I guess I would trade that feeling for the other way around. But as you know too, Matt, one of the things, and this is sort of an interesting technology thing, when I started in the business, you know, almost 40 years ago, we had the laptop where you could see 3 lines of it, the Radio Shack Tandy. They called it the Trash 100, I think was the nickname. And you could not see anything else on the screen. So it was a bit of a heavy lift just to move a paragraph. And, you know, he had to have coding and block it off and scroll. You might lose it on the way. And I bring that up because it's just the evolution of the way we do this now is I'm not even sure I make it through a full draft. I rarely make it through a full draft of something before I'm changing things. I mean, I'll just kind of stop and start, go through a couple paragraphs again. So there's something a little fascinating about thinking back historically when, and I don't mean to be lofty about this writing versus books and stuff, but you know, when you could see an original draft versus what it becomes, I don't think that probably happens that way as much anymore, because I think people are constantly just reworking and reworking along the way.
In radio, I do not like listening to myself. There's an amount that I have to do to edit stuff and put it together, but I do not like listening to old pieces. I don't like listening to myself do old games. Do you enjoy, like, once it's out of the process, it's been posted, and do you enjoy looking back at your old stuff, or do you, once it's done, and what's next?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and I think there's an interesting parallel track to that. I seldom look back at anything unless I'm looking something up for research. There's an old saying about hating to write but loving to have written. A lot of times I think I feel like that, like the sense of accomplishment, the challenge. I think that's motivating in itself. And I suppose if I didn't feel daunted each time, then it'd be a little bit like one of those notions of why keep doing it if you don't feel like that. So I think that's healthy for me. It is funny you said that specifically about your voice, though. When I listen back to interviews, when I'm transcribing interviews, I cannot tell you how many times to this day I think, oh, why was that question so long? Or why did I interject there? Why didn't I interject there? And again, I hope that doesn't sound too anxiety-ridden. I think the point in bringing it up is that you realize you should keep learning, and you hope you don't keep making the same mistakes. I have a friend who's a funny guy. He now works for the Royals, but he used to be a colleague of mine. And we used to joke about when you're either asking a question or you're writing and you get that feeling you're going to the hoop with the ball and you're not quite sure what you're going to do with it. He always would say, hey, that's when the magic happens. And I'm always worried that's when I get, you know, thrown flat on my back. But he's right. And that's how you need to look at it. You know, just keep refining and thinking about, okay, I'll keep working with this. It's always a work in progress.
When did you know you wanted to be a writer?
Well, that's a good question. I felt like I was talking big about wanting to write for a long time and not doing it. When I was at Penn, I thought about, you know, I was an English major and I thought about both writing and I thought about wanting to teach English and coach football at high school level, but I didn't do much about it. And by the time I got done with school, I was still talking about writing, and I didn't take a job teaching at a school, prep school in Connecticut. I just wasn't ready to do it. I don't know why. Maybe because you had to live on campus and it was paying $8,000, but that's short-sighted, right? I mean, if I really wanted to do that, I could have done it then. But I ended up in a couple of other jobs and started to think I'm not really going the direction. I haven't really found what I think will, you know, fulfill me. And a friend of the family knew that I was interested in writing and suggested I apply to the University of Missouri for journalism school, for grad school. And I don't know. I don't know why I took the good advice, but it landed. And that's when I guess I had to say, well, I'm not just talking about it. I guess I'm going to go give it a whirl. You know, just a funny side story was that I was pretty Northeast centric at that point. And so I thought I should apply to a different journalism school closer to home. So I applied to Columbia as well. And I had to go take a written test or a typing test for Columbia at a alum's house. And I got there and I pulled out my typewriter from the car and my pants split. And I remember thinking, this is not a good omen. And I'm sure I didn't do well on the writing test. And so I didn't get in Columbia, and I did get in Missouri. And I was, you know, a little anxious about making that move across country, but it was very good for me, and it redirected a lot of things about my career path, obviously.
Were you comfortable right away in the journalism school? Like you get a year in, was it like, okay, yes?
You know, comfortable is not quite the word, but the point I think you're making is correct. I it wasn't like I felt like, oh, this is just coming right to me and this is just a snap or anything like that. But I felt really exhilarated by what it felt like to start doing it. First, you're kind of just doing papers and journalism classes, but then the student paper there, I had one of the local high school girls basketball beats. And, you know, I can still remember covering the first game I covered. Janie Jackson led the team with 8 points. But the coach, her name was Lisa Holt. She was really good to me and tolerated a lot of dumb questions. And suddenly you just start feeling like you've got your legs under you. And so I felt like I don't exactly know where it's going, but this seems like the right direction.
Now, you were born in Lebanon, correct?
I was. I was born in Beirut. Without giving you the, I'll try to give you the cliff notes. You know, my mom was from New Jersey. My dad was from Iran. They met in school in California, and he went back to the Middle East, to Lebanon, to do his dissertation about Afghanistan in the early 60s. And all that explains why I'm in Kansas City today. It's just kind of a funny path. So, but yeah, born there, we weren't there long. He was doing that. And we were basically in California at the time and were there for a few years. And then on to Texas, my dad launched further into his academic career and at the University of Texas. And then he came to Penn to teach in the early 70s. So that's when we got to Philadelphia and to Swarthmore, where I grew up.
Now, you played football, we mentioned, at Penn. Was sports a big part of your life throughout as a kid?
It was. It was probably a little too much of my identity in some ways. I think I got knee-deep in it, and yet I think it also, that accounts for why I wanted to do this for a career. But we were a small high school, so back then, it was far enough back, small enough school that I got to play on both sides of the ball. And then I just thought I'd really like to give it a try at Penn. And freshman year worked out pretty well back in the days of the freshman team, and was doing well, and broke my ankle in the fourth game, I guess, and had to get reconstructive surgery. Was not altogether fast to begin with, and that didn't speed me up. And the bookend of this is that by senior year, I was hoping to get more playing time, but Coach Burnt had one of the all-time lines. He pulled me aside right before the season started and said, "Well, I'd love to play you, Vahe, but you're not fast enough for your size and you're not big enough for your speed." And I remember thinking, well, it's pretty jarring, but at least it's not my fault. But I tell you what, the whole Penn football experience was wonderful. I didn't get to play very much, just a few games over the years, but I think you know the arc of this. I mean, that was during an era where we won 2 games in 3 years before my senior year and then tied for the Ivy Championship in 1982. My wife likes to tease me that was a three-way tie in an 8-team league, but I don't think she understood, you know, how momentous it was. It had been decades before that. And really, Matt, I always think of that. I would not have drawn that up any other way. Maybe I would have gotten to be on the field more. But I mean, as far as sort of the agony before the ecstasy and that bond that we all had from pushing through to have that outcome, you know, a lot of us are still pretty close to this day, and maybe we would be even if it didn't work out senior year, but that added a certain layer to it all.
That senior year, after all the struggles from a win-loss standpoint for the first few years of your career, when did it feel like it was different? Did it need the results to feel different, or did it feel different in camp early on?
Yeah, I think it did. You know, it's funny. We felt pretty good after the first game our junior year, and then just I think we lost something like 58-0 a week later to Lehigh or Lafayette, and things just didn't really take off. But I think by then the feeling was, you know, I know that we'd had a pretty good off-season program, that people were – it was much more refined. And I think the culture was good. I don't know that the culture was bad before. Everybody loved Coach Gamble, but Coach Burnt, I think, kind of reset some things. And I think there was a notable upgrade in recruiting. A lot of the younger guys really were players that were coveted. Not that guys our age weren't. There were a lot of guys on our team that were really good. But I think the combination of the system, the hard work, identifying who should be out there, I think our line play was good. So all those things just kind of coalesced. And, you know, the moment, of course, was that win over Harvard with the penalty at the end that Harvard disputed but was absolutely wrong about.
How much does your experience as a college athlete make you a better sports writer? Because you have maybe a little bit more appreciation for the process, even as someone who didn't play a ton. But
yeah,
you understand what goes into a week of work to get ready for Saturday. Do you think that has helped you in your sports writing career?
I do think so, at least in this sense. I feel somewhat able to relate to the struggle. Like when you think about how, like when a team struggles or when a player struggles, it's not an unfamiliar thing to see that, and to, for lack of a better term, be able to empathize and also just try to understand the whole context of this, like that it's always on to the next for that athlete. And so I do think it helps me. I don't want to be grandiose about it, but I think it is good to have had some sliver of a sense of what the experience might be like, both in terms of the sports themselves, but also the feeling of triumph versus failure, you know, that all those feelings at once. I do think that helps. I certainly wouldn't say you have to have played X sport to cover X sport or anything like that, but I think it can open up your mind a little bit to some things.
Was there a point when you decided you wanted to stay in the Midwest after Missouri, or was it more opportunity driven that this is where the opportunities you felt comfortable and you thought would advance you kind of led?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a fusion of all that, Matt. Certainly when I came out, it was 1986, and I came out to Missouri with my friend who lives at the Jersey Shore now, John Shirk. We drove out together. I just figured I'd get done with school and get back in 2 years. But then, you know, my last semester at Missouri was an internship at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and that morphed into a job, which was a job certainly was fortunate to get at that point. I mean, it usually you have to make a step or two to get to a metro paper that size, but the internship kind of, you know, was my way in. And basically things just kept gaining momentum there. I started doing the University of Missouri beat, which was one of our prominent beats there. Certainly not the Cardinals or the Blues or the NFL, yeah, the Rams and before them, the Cardinals there. But it was a notable beat. And then that kind of morphed into national college beat. And then next thing you know, I'm covering the Olympics. And all those things were just so engrossing. And each thing kind of led to the next. So my mom was constantly, well, when are you moving back here? And I'd say, well, you know, any year now. And I learned a word from her called, the word is velleity, which means an impulse barely felt with no oomph behind it. And she accused me of that, basically, that I wasn't really trying. And I think I did try. And I was certainly interested in coming back to Philadelphia, the papers there and New York and a couple of things, but it didn't quite take. And I more and more became enamored of living out here. So I was at St. Louis 25 years before I came over to Kansas City 12 years ago.
We need to take a break. We will have more with Vahe Gregorian in just a few moments, but I want to remind you right now that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. Meet the next generation of vehicles. Check out the Honda Prologue, Accord Hybrid, or Civic Hybrid. For a limited time, you can get 0.99% APR on a 2025 Prologue, a 2.99% APR on a 2025 Accord Hybrid, or a 4.99% APR on a 2025 Civic Hybrid. Contact your local Honda dealer today. Offers applicable only to well-qualified buyers. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's get back to our conversation with Vahe Gregorian, sports columnist for the Kansas City Star. We talked about what goes into being a columnist, those days when you're covering a beat. I would imagine it can just be exhausting, because especially something that, you know, a recruiting thing might break at, you know, midnight on a Friday or something like that. And the last thing you want to do as a beat person is get beaten by somebody else. How hard was it to get your arms around kind of the enormity of what goes into a beat?
Yeah, that's really a astute way to look at it, because you do feel a sense of ownership and you're competing. I mean, maybe the best example I could give is covering the University of Missouri. There were 7, 8, 10 other outlets covering it at the same time when I was covering it for the Post-Dispatch. And you're miserable when somebody else breaks news and you're playing catch up. But the only way to break news is to be constantly making the extra calls and doing the things that disrupt your life a little bit. So it's a hard balance to achieve. So you just keep going. And if you care about it, you have pride in your work, you just are in the mix of it all the time. It is also a little bit, though, like the Woody Allen thing about 90% of life is just showing up. You know, be at everything you should be at, right? Make the extra calls, just keep doing that. And I found that to be just a helpful way of looking at it. Like, you know, like coaches like to say, be fundamentally sound. And then over time, naturally, you just get to know people. Fortunately for me, I'm pretty outgoing, and it's pretty natural for me to want to connect with people. It just sort of energizes me. And actually, one of the reasons I think I've loved the work for so long, it's about that engagement.
When you're on a beat, or when you cover something consistently, once again, I want to kind of pull the curtain back for listeners. Like, you obviously are being objective and doing everything you can to just call it like it is, but you're also a human being, and especially when you're on a specific beat and you see guys in season 5, 6 times a week, if not more, you talk to them, you're going to develop a relationship. And sometimes it's, wow, that guy, he's a really good guy. And then there's sometimes like, okay, I've got to do this. Like, how do you balance those human emotions of, and not let it color the direction that you paint things? And I don't even mean consciously. I just mean there's just if you have an affinity for somebody, you are going to give them the benefit of the doubt, stuff like that, and vice versa. How do you battle that?
Yeah, it's in a lot of ways one of the most paramount questions of all, right? Because you could do a panel discussion about this concept. You know, you're covering the beat. You need to be fair-minded. You need to be able to connect with people and engender their trust. But you also have to be able to criticize, you know, things. I mean, this goes on all the time in my column role, which is a little different than the beat role. But I think in the end, being fair-minded is important. I try to just tell myself, I can be critical without being mean-spirited. Now, there's some people that are very witty, and what comes with that is things that can come off mean-spirited. I don't feel like, back to something you asked earlier, I don't feel like my voice is sincere if it's snarky. But I think I have to be able to take aim at things and call them out. I mean, we've had some conflicting, complicated situations here, as you'd imagine, with things like Tyreek Hill or with other, you know, with arrests and things like that. And each of these things, I think you got to roll up the sleeves and make sure you get as far as your headlights take you. And don't go beyond that, right? Don't go beyond declaring you know things that you don't. Because once you get to that place, then you're really in a bad spiral. So I guess back to the original question, really, it's you just, to me, try to be fair-minded, try to be accountable. You made this point when you're seeing people 4, 5, 6 times a week, or even if you're not, you know, one of the prime directives is you got to always show up after you've written something critical. We had a situation with the Royals a couple years ago. It's too complicated to really go on about, but where their general manager was openly considering drafting a guy who'd had some real trouble in college, and it was kind of third rail stuff. And he had talked about that, and I know his spirit is right. I mean, his name's Dayton Moore. He's one of the finest people I've ever known. But I just thought he was wrong, and for a lot of reasons. But I thought it was important that Dayton knew this was coming, and I wanted to make sure he had a chance to both address it, but also know it was coming. So I called him the night before. I said, "Hey, Dayton, so I'm writing this," and he didn't. It's not like he was pleased to hear that. But then a year or two later, he told me that I'd persuaded him not to do it. And now that story is really more about him than me, because who do you know in sports that tells you they listened to something you said that way? And it is unusual. It's probably not that valuable story because it's so rare. But I think it speaks to the whole question you're asking, right? You just try to, you don't try to sneak something by somebody. You show up, and, you know, sometimes people are mad at you. That's just how it is. But I think if you feel like you are at least logical and fair in how you approached it, it works out.
as a professional, do you remember the first time you felt like you really hit it out of the park? Either a scoop, something you wrote, just something that resonated with the audience, or just resonated with yourself. The first time you were like, that's it.
You know, what comes to mind immediately, let's go with first thought, best thought, is a breaking news thing that I think would probably be trivial to anybody outside our market, but it was when Missouri was hiring a new coach, and they ended up hiring Larry Smith, and I'd been on the phone all day, couldn't get anywhere. And then a guy I had met at a chance meeting in Stillwater, Oklahoma once, who was going to be on somebody else's staff, called me and said, hey, just so you know, Larry Smith's getting the job, not our guys. And then I called Larry Smith. I'd already spoken with him, but I called him and he said, I asked him if that was true, and he laughed and he said, only the gods know where I'll be tomorrow. And which I took to be, yeah, you got it. And I got it a couple other places. But the reason it was really exhilarating was that this was like 11 o'clock at night in the era where, you know, we still replayed the newspaper. And so I'm on the phone and they're tearing up the front page and it's going out there. And I knew nobody else had the story. So that was its own thing. I generally speaking, take more pride in hoping a story is emotional and resonates with the human experience, for lack of a better term. But that's what comes to mind when I think of something that was, you know, what newspapering was really all about.
At any point, did you feel like yelling, stop the presses?
I really did. And luckily somebody was doing it for me. I'd probably be way too dramatic. I think it probably came in before deadline, but it felt like that.
You mentioned the coverage of the Olympics. What are some favorite Olympic memories over the years for you?
Yeah, I was fortunate to go to 10 Olympics, and these things blur together. It's just some amazing things. But I bet you most reporters that have covered Olympics would tell you this. I mean, I was there for Michael Phelps, I think 7 of the 8 gold medals, and Simone Biles a couple times, and Michael Johnson, and you know, all these things, and really neat stories about culture and people winning in other countries. But when it comes right down to it, the feeling of spending time around the local athlete that you've gotten to know, I mean, in the end, that's the highest calling of covering the Olympics for a local paper. And that was just endlessly rewarding. And sometimes it was agonizing. We had a guy from St. Louis who was a wrestler who got to the gold medal, the final in Sydney in 2000 and lost and only got the silver medal. But he was so traumatized, basically. He tore his singlet down and ran through the stands screaming. And now I'm in this position to have to follow him, but I knew him well and waited him out for a couple hours and felt like I was able to tell that story in the proper way. And then to bookend that, the last Olympics I went to was Rio when I was working here in Kansas City. And we had an archer from a small town, Wellington, Missouri. And, you know, I went to the house and got to know the family and saw where he learned to become an archer. And that led to me sitting with his mom in the stands when he won a silver medal. Those are the things that I think are most special, because those are the things that allow you to be in the middle of it and take people where they don't get to go. I mean, you know, you can't replicate that. And you've been in the gaggles. I'm sure you've had experiences where, you know, you're just hoping to get a question in. That's different than you're sort of immersed. And that's the thing I'm sad about, because I think a lot of outlets aren't able to afford to go to Olympics anymore. And that it's a dimension that's going to be lost in the coverage.
You mentioned earlier that you're a bit outgoing. So I don't know. One of the things, and not that I'm famous, but when you're on the radio, the name and stuff like that, you can get recognized and stuff like that. And it took me a while to kind of get used to that as a writer. And then as a columnist, you start to kind of develop a name that people, oh yeah, you did the thing on so-and-so. Were you comfortable with that type of notoriety? Because it can kind of hit from anywhere and it can kind of catch you flat-footed.
Yeah, it you know, more so, as you note, with the column thing, because then your mugshot's in the paper. And I always used to joke, you know, it's a face made for radio, but I can't say that to you.
Oh, I'm living that dream, baby.
But it is something, especially in a small town. I mean, Kansas City is, I think, still a big small town. I mean, it's growing. It's got a lot going for it, but feels a little bit like everybody knows everybody here in ways that you wouldn't feel in the Philly area. I mean, of course you do, but not quite as intimately. So I do think, you know, I'm just conscious of that somebody might have a reference point to me. And I can't think of a time somebody wasn't very nice about it. I mean, I suppose somebody could be confrontational, but I haven't had that happen. I get plenty of that by email or social media, and that's its own thing. But in public, people tend to be very nice if they do somehow recognize me or feel that they should say hi.
You mentioned social media. How has that changed the job?
Well, you know, back to the term you used earlier, I think this would behoove everybody, right, to think about who you're trying to be and what your voice is on social media. And I was persuaded that I needed to get on there. One of my great bosses back in the day, Reed Lamance, found the right way to convince me you had to get on Twitter, which was to say, you got to be your own paper boy. And, you know, so that was easy enough to think of. Like, I'm just like flipping the paper out on the lawn by hitting this button. But then you start getting the sense it's an opportunity to comment in certain instances. And so I think I tried a few things and then kind of settled into the way I look at it. I mean, it's funny. I sometimes I'm at an event and I realize I'm just doing it over like Twitter X over and over. Not really sure why. It's just like an outlet. I mean, it just like at the Super Bowl, naturally you feel compelled to do it because you feel like you're going back and forth with your audience a little bit, which I think at its best is pretty good. I try to, I do this with email and I try to do it online on social media too. I don't want to just dismiss somebody if they're coming at me. On the other hand, if you try to be reasonable with somebody and they just keep being unreasonable, I don't see much reason to keep it going. And once in a while that prevails and makes something just smooth over and you feel like somebody understands you and you understand them better. But I think it's one of those things where you can't expect the reaction you hope for. You just have to hope you're saying the right thing to make yourself feel like you've stood your ground, declared your point, and move on.
To that point, as a columnist, it is a hot take. Like you're giving your thoughts on something, but obviously you do it in a very thoughtful, well thought out way, which is almost in direct contrast with what drives the train in sports media these days, which is let me just shoot from the hip. And in many cases, let me just be a contrarian to be a contrarian's sake, because then I'll get engagement and that will lead. Like, how frustrating, if at all, do you find the sports media landscape now, not digging at anybody specific, but just overall with kind of what really moves the needle?
Yeah, and yeah, you're hitting a nerve. Let me say one thing first, and I'll turn to that point. I'm really grateful to the so I was a reporter for 25 years, and so all the time I'm essentially looking to tell the story as objectively as possible, trying to make sure I've got everything framed in that even-handed way. And then after 25 years, I'm given the latitude to have my own voice. But I realized early on that I don't want to shoot from the hip. I want reported columns. I want to make sure I've talked to people. And I learned from people around me that, you know, they weren't just riffing. The people that I've learned from and been around were, I think, very responsible. And so I came into it with that mindset that I'll have a voice, and I'm capable of outrage, but I'm not going to just do it to do it. And I'm thankful that the stars allowed me to be myself, because I'm sure in this climate that's against the grain. But to your broader question, it is frustrating to see misleading headlines in any number of media, right? And I can think of 10 things a week, that 10 things a day that you see that are sometimes the things I've attended. And I see it just totally mischaracterized in the headline. I'll give you an example. The other day with Travis Kelce, you know, he made a comment. He was talking about he's not quite sure whether this will be the last year. And he said something like, all I know is I've got one year left on my contract. The Times of India had a headline that said 1 year left. You know, Kelce says 1 year left. I'm not getting it verbatim, but that 1 year left, and this leads to a sad question or something to that effect. It was, no, he didn't say I have 1 year left. He said I have 1 year left on my contract. That's a good example because it just shows you how you can make a bite into a bite into a bite, and it's just misleading. So I find that frustrating, mostly because it is a sad reflection of the direction of the business. And I'm not sure what's going to combat it, right? I mean, all you can do is try to uphold what you think the standard should be and hope that that is what prevails on this. But it's just very hard to see where that trajectory is going and how it's going to get come back into being more responsible overall.
Is there something on your work bucket list that you haven't checked off, either an event you would like to cover or someone that you realistically would like to talk to for something? Are there things that you still want to make sure those boxes are checked before it's over?
You know, I've been really fortunate to do so many things, you know, the Super Bowls and Kentucky Derbies and Final Fours and the Masters and all those Olympics, et cetera. It's kind of funny that one of the things I haven't gotten to cover is going to be coming here, as it will be to Philly, the World Cup next year. And I don't know that I would have said it's on my bucket list exactly, but I'm fascinated by it. And the idea that one of, if not the world's most momentous sporting events, it will be held here among the 16 cities in North America is pretty darn cool. I don't know that I would have found the money. I don't think the paper would find the money to go, you know, abroad to a World Cup, but to have it here, that's a nice thing to have just in our laps that way. And what's exciting about that also is that whatever it would mean to cover it in another country is its own thing. But here, what we'll have is the really enticing landscape of that being overlaid on this city, right? A place that we feel like is a city on the move, but that will be, I think, quite challenged to handle it well with security and transportation and everything. And I think people that are handling it are very capable, and I look forward to it. But I think that they'll be challenged to handle the hundreds of thousands of people coming here.
And my final question for you, of your career, what are you most proud of?
That's hard to answer. I guess I feel like maybe the thing that I can bring best to the work is, I hope I'm an empathetic person, and I hope that's been my consistent strength in the job. And I think the most rewarding thing has been all the relationships and you know, with the people you cover, but that's its own thing. But also maybe most significantly day in, day out with your teammates and with brothers and sisters in the media around the country. I don't think people outside the business would have any idea how vital that is to have those relationships, how much it keeps you going and day in, day out. And I'm sure it's added a lot to your work, Matt, to be around great colleagues that way. So I think all those things kind of go together. Yeah, it certainly would be almost impossible to point to favorite memories, which is, I guess, a pretty lucky thing to be able to say, because I feel like there's been so many.
Vahe Gregorian, thanks so much for the time. This was tremendous.
Thanks, Matt. This was tremendous for me. I really enjoyed it.
And that will do it for this episode of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank Vahe Gregorian, sports columnist for the Kansas City Star, for being our guest this week. Now, if you like the show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at One-on-One Pod. You can follow me there as well at Matt Leon 1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers health care on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour, with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar Free. First round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Hate doing cardio? Try brushing and flossing your teeth. I'm not talking about building up a sweat. I'm talking about building a healthier mouth for a healthier heart, for a healthier you. Smile Generation. Trusted dentists look at your care through the lens of the mouth-body connection, because what happens in the mouth plays a critical role for the rest of your body. To find a dentist near you, committed to treating all of you, visit smilegeneration.com/confidence today and live longer, healthier, and happier with Confidence Unleashed.